From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! In today's St. Patrick's Day special, we observe the 150th anniversary of the Irish potato famine, known as Black 47. Was it a natural disaster, or was it genocide? And an update on jailed Irish activist Roisin McCloskey. Our guest, her mother, human rights activist Bernadette Devlin McCloskey. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A top Republican senator asserted yesterday that the Clinton administration knew China was trying to buy political influence illegally a year before the 1996 presidential election. Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah, a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, which is investigating the affair, said on CBS's Face the Nation that despite this knowledge, the Democrats relied on fundraisers with ties to China. Hatch said that the FBI had warned the State Department, the CIA, the Justice Department, two congressional committees, and as many as seven lawmakers as early as 1995 of China's intentions to make illegal campaign contributions. That was a year before the Federal Bureau of Investigation told National Security Council staffers at the White House in June 96, a warning that President Clinton said last week he never received and which led to an unusual flare-up with the FBI. And we have this news from Golem Beach in Albania. It says U.S. Marines stormed out of helicopters onto Golem Beach south of Durrës to rescue American, Turkish, and Italian citizens from the chaos of Albania. This news from Reuters in Jerusalem. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said after meeting Jordan's King Hussein yesterday that Israel would stick to its plans to build a Jewish settlement in Arab East Jerusalem. Oklahoma City bombing defendant Timothy McVeigh admitted his role in blowing up the federal building during a lie detector test by his lawyers. This, according to Newsweek magazine. In its latest edition, out today, Newsweek says that sources close to the case told them McVeigh had, quote, confirmed his role in blowing up the Murrah building on a lie detector test administered by his own lawyers. The magazine said, however, that McVeigh flunked a question about whether all of his co-conspirators were known to authorities, leaving confusion about whether the FBI had tracked down all the members of the conspiracy. Newsweek said investigators were not sure whether the story about the lie detector was simply a defense ploy to sow confusion on the eve of the trial. Hundreds of Germans demonstrated against racism yesterday in the tiny village of Dolgenbrot, which has become infamous for a firebomb attack on an asylum home in 1992. Around 300 demonstrators, outnumbered by police officers, shouted death to fascism and death to state terrorism as they gathered a field at the entrance to Dolgenbrot, a village of just 300 inhabitants south of Berlin. Meanwhile, this news from Bonn, the German news magazine Der Spiegel said yesterday a U.S. diplomat ordered out of the country for spying was digging for information about Germany's controversial trade ties with Iran. The alleged spy and his predecessor, who left Bonn last year, tried to get a senior economics ministry official to name German firms selling high-tech equipment to Iran. They also asked about Bonn's official credit guarantees for German exports to Iran, a German-built nuclear plant in Iran, the 1995 expulsion of two Iranian spies from Bonn, and a Berlin murder trial at which German prosecutors have accused Tehran of state terrorism. This news from Turkey. Rights campaigners and political analysts have dismissed assertions by Turkey and its close ally, the United States, that the country is at last tackling its poor human rights record. Rights workers at home and abroad say the most recent reforms announced by the foreign ministry last week are little more than another sop to Western Europe, where concern for abuses has limited integration with its big eastern neighbor. Hillary Rodham Clinton has arrived in Senegal, the first stop on a Six Nation goodwill tour. Accompanied by daughter Chelsea, she's visiting a house where slaves were held before being shipped to America. She also plans to visit a girls' school named after Martin Luther King Jr. and meet with Senegal's president before departing for South Africa. Prime Minister John Major has called a national election for May 1st and says, "I think we'll run." Major's conservative party, in power for 18 years, is far behind a revitalized Labor Party in opinion polls. The announcement signaled the start of a six-week campaign, which is likely to include the first broadcast debates between leaders of the major parties. And a British soldier said in remarks published yesterday that his platoon was given shoot-to-kill orders on the eve of Bloody Sunday, when 13 unarmed Northern Ireland demonstrators were killed by army gunfire. The unnamed soldier told the Sunday Business Post, in direct contradiction of official accounts of the 1972 shooting, that none of the demonstrators he saw was armed, and some of his colleagues continued to shoot at them after a ceasefire order. And you're listening to Democracy Now!
Okay, I want to talk about Ireland. Specifically, I want to talk about the famine, about the fact that there never really was one. There was no famine. See, Irish people were only allowed to eat potatoes. All of the other food, meat, fish, vegetables, were shipped out of the country under armed guard to England while the Irish people starved. And then, in the middle of all this, they gave us money not to teach our children Irish. And so we lost our history, and this is what I think is still hurting me. You see, we're like a child that, being battered, has to drive itself out of its head because it's frightened, still feels all the painful feelings. But they lose contact with the memory, and this leads to massive self-destruction, alcoholism, drug addiction, all desperate attempts at running. And in its worst form, becomes actual killing. And if there ever is gonna be healing, there has to be remembering and then grieving, so that there then can be forgiving. There has to be knowledge and understanding. All the lonely people, where do they all come from? An American army regulation says you mustn't kill more than 10% of a nation, because to do so causes permanent psychological damage. It's not permanent, but they didn't know that. Anyway, during the supposed famine, we lost a lot more than 10% of our nation through deaths on land or in ships of emigration. But what finally broke us was not starvation, but its use in the controlling of our education. Schools go on about Black 47, on and on about the terrible famine. But what they don't say is, in truth, there really never was one.
Excuse me.
The lonely people.
I'm sorry, excuse me.
Where do they all come from?
Fact. I can tell you in one word.
Oh, the lonely people. Where do they all belong? So let's take a look, shall we? The highest statistics of child abuse in the EEC, and we say we're a Christian country, but we've lost contact with our history. See, we used to worship God as a mother. We're suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Look at all our old men in the pubs. Look at all our young people on drugs. We used to worship God as a mother. Now look at what we're doing to each other. We've even made killers of ourselves, the most childlike trusting people in the universe. And this is what's wrong with us. Our history books, the parent figures lied to us. I see the Irish as a race like a child that got itself bashed in the face. And if there ever is gonna be healing, there has to be remembering and then grieving, so that there then can be forgiving. There has to be knowledge.
You're listening to Sinead O'Connor singing Famine on her CD Universal Mother. Yes, today is St. Patrick's Day, and millions of people of Irish descent will be throwing parades and parties to celebrate the day. But what tends to get lost in all the hoopla is the political history of Ireland and the struggles that are still going on today. In New York, where the largest St. Patrick's Day takes place, the parade today, 100,000 people are expected to attend, and among the things they'll be doing is observing a moment of silence in honor of the 150th anniversary of Black 47, or 1847, the worst year of the Irish potato famine. Today on Democracy Now!, we're going to take a look at the famine, one of the seminal moments in Irish and American history, and get a broad overview of how colonialism has affected Irish culture and society as a whole. Joining us now is Garrett O'Connor, a medical doctor and professor of psychiatry at the University of California at Los Angeles. He specializes in the psychological effects of colonialism. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dr. O'Connor.
Oh, good morning. Good morning, Amy. Good
morning. Well, can you tell us a little about how you feel the Irish potato famine of 1847, at least that was the worst year, shaped the consciousness of the Irish people?
Well, the famine was one event in a long process of colonial neglect, disregard, and exploitation of segments of the Irish people by the English government for its own purposes and benefits. And the famine, the damage, the psychological damage of the famine was predated by several hundred years of policies by the government which were specifically designed to undermine the spirit of the Irish people, remove them from their lands, destroy the structure of Irish society, and in general reduce the segments, at least, of the Irish population to poverty and insignificance. And so then the famine came along in the middle of the 19th century on the tail end of that 200 or 300 years of discrimination to weaken the people who were weakened already in many ways by what had happened to them and their institutions, the church, and caused this widespread devastation through disease, starvation, death, and emigration, so that it's a very significant percentage of the people, about 25%, as a matter of fact, and over a period of 10 years, either left the country by emigration or died. More than a million people died of the famine through starvation and disease. And what people heard Sinead O'Connor sing about just in the introduction to the program is actually, and from my point of view, psychologically speaking, a very accurate rendition and interpretation of what happened. That the people of the country, the culture, we know that the children who grow up in abusive families learn to adapt, to survive, with behaviors that they themselves carry into adult life and then have in many ways a tendency to pass on the abuse to their own children down through the generations that they then received as children themselves. And my particular work is involved with the examination of whether or not the same thing could happen to a whole culture. That if you abused a culture for long enough, would it internalize the abuse and then pass that abuse down consciously or unconsciously to the subsequent generations in the form of values, traditions, family situations, and so on. And I believe that that's indeed what's happened, so that the history, the psychological history of the famine continues to live on in segments of the Irish Catholic population particularly, in much the same way as the events of any major psychological event continue to live on in the generations of the people who suffer from it, like, for example, the Jews continue to suffer from the effects of the Holocaust in very visible and manifest ways from a psychological point of view. The Irish famine is only 150 years ago, and we continue to suffer in many psychological ways from that attack and that assault on our spirituality and our, and indeed on our very existence.
You take a kind of Frantz Fanon approach to colonialism. He looked at Africa. You're looking today at Ireland and the effects of the British occupation, Dr. O'Connor. Can you talk a little about how you got into this psychological approach to looking at political issues?
Well, having been born in Ireland myself, I'm trying to work out and work through my own psychology as I grew up and developed. I began to look for ways to try and understand it, and that led me to Fanon in the 60s, and later on to the study of the survivors of the Nazi Holocaust in Germany from the camps, and then subsequently into making connections between that sort of survival behavior and people who had lived through the famine. My own relatives and antecedents lived through the famine, Matt Harris and others in my own past. And so it was through an effort to really sort out my own personal situation that led me to make some, because of my interest and clinical background in psychiatry, led me to make some of these connections. And I came to understanding or to exploring the consequences of the famine through reading the literature on the survivors of the Holocaust. And I have found many parallels in that in order to survive terrible traumas such as famines, efforts at genocide and discrimination, people's resort to all sorts of survival behaviors which later are silenced through shame. And I think that looking back on the famine, although we know very little about what actually happened to the people during the famine, there must have been many reasons for people to be concerned and ashamed because of what their ancestors may have done in order to survive, and that these behaviors have been handed down through the generations as a sort of shameful silence that can't be spoken about, and that the character of the Irish has tended at times for various reasons to become a sort of caricature, and that many Irish people have lost touch with their authenticity and have become caricatures of whom they really are, and therefore have difficulty in experiencing themselves as fully authentic people. The stage Irish person, the kind of antics, and there's a poster out here for the Irish Fair, St. Patrick's Day Fair, with an idiotic man dressed up as a leprechaun throwing horseshoes. This is paddy whackery. This is self-destructive, self-denigrating behavior on the part of Irish people who are prepared to, in seeking their own identity, to perform like dancing bears in some ways, in ways that they're expected to by people who have a particular stereotypical view of who they are. Much of Irish alcoholism and drinking is connected to this sort of expectation of who Irish people are. They drink, they fight, they argue, they're always happy. And yet the truth of the Irish person is that Irish people are just like everybody else, not too different, and they experience suffering, they experience joy, generosity, courage, nobility, shame. They commit murder, they perjure themselves in court, they seek revenge. They do all of the things that people in general do, and yet they have this extraordinary capacity for survival and the ability to overcome adversity that is also, of course, a great benefit from years of having had to survive under adverse conditions. But the most important consequence of all of this, I think, for us today, is the tendency that Irish people, as Sinead O'Connor says, not very good at handling our strong feelings, because for so many years, like abused children, the culture had to suppress its feelings because they were so strong that they were unmanageable. And this has resulted in, I think, a rather generalized trend towards awkward intimacy in Irish people in families, difficulty of dealing with intimate feelings, fear of being exposed as foolish or inadequate or insecure in some way, being either unrealistically pessimistic or unrealistically optimistic, believing that tragedy is a normal way of living, and being quite surprised and concerned when success comes our way. Alcoholism, depression, suicide, ruined marriages, child abuse. All of these things are very prevalent, certainly in Ireland, although they're also hard to measure. But nevertheless, they're prevalent and are inconsistent with the public image of being Irish. And if I have a mission or a goal, it is to help us Irish people to integrate both the shameful aspects of our past with the noble aspects of our past, so that we're neither one nor the other, we're both, and we're can have integrity and wholeness about us, and not just a narrow and shallow characterological facade of being Irish, whatever that means. And that tends at times to come out on St. Patrick's Day, where drinking, alcoholism, general raucous behavior is what people see rather than the extraordinary nobility of the Irish people who have, after all, managed to survive in extraordinary ways the adverse conditions over many centuries and more recently from the famine and its aftermath.
Dr. O'Connor, we do have to wrap up, but
yes.
If people want to get a hold of your study, Recognizing and Healing Malignant Shame, a statement about the urgent need for psychological and spiritual recovery from the effects of colonialism in Ireland, can they call a number or is this report on a website?
Yes, it is on a website. Oh, my goodness, I wish I had right in front of me the website of which the report is.
Well, you can call us back during the show. Our producer can take your call and let us know what the address is, and we'll say it at the end of the program.
Okay, what's the number to call? Because I don't have it.
Well, our producer will talk to you in a minute.
Oh, okay.
But thanks very much, Dr. O'Connor.
Thank you.
Again, Dr. O'Connor, a professor of psychiatry at the University of California at Los Angeles. He specializes in the psychological effects of colonialism. Up next, we take a look at what people are doing in the current analysis of this 150th anniversary of Black 47, the Irish potato famine of 1847. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Irish activists and human rights groups are organizing to win official recognition that the Irish potato famine of the mid-19th century was genocide. Already some public schools around the country are now teaching that the Irish potato famine, which claimed an estimated 1 million lives, was a deliberate act of genocide by the British government. And activists are planning to stage an international tribunal to hold the British government accountable for their actions. Here to discuss the legal and political ramifications of the famine are two guests. We're joined by Francis Boyle, a professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law in Champaign-Urbana. He recently litigated and won two genocide cases at the World Court on behalf of Bosnia against Yugoslavia. And we're also joined by Owen Rogers, chair of the New York-based group Famine Was Genocide Committee. Let's begin with Professor Boyle. Can you talk a little about, just to give us some background on the potato famine of 1847?
Well, yes, within the context of what we're dealing with here, when the potato famine started under the Peel government, immediately the prime minister at that time began to organize relief supplies to the starving people of Ireland. He recognized full well that if something was not done, you were going to have large numbers of deaths on your hands. He lost an election to the Whigs over, in part, this issue. And when they came to power under Lord Russell, they immediately terminated all forms of relief supplies to the starving people of Ireland, thus starting off a period of mass starvation. So for our purposes here, in terms of establishing genocide, I believe the critical point on the question of intent, because with respect to the crime of genocide, you must establish an intent to destroy a racial, ethnic, national, or religious group as such. And clearly the change in policies by the British government from Peel to Russell, from feeding the starving people of Ireland to basically starving them deliberately and purposely, in my opinion, commenced the genocide against the Irish people.
We're also joined by Professor Christine Keneally, a professor of British and Irish history at the University of Liverpool. And she's written a new book called A Death-Dealing Famine, The Great Hunger in Ireland. Why, Professor Keneally, do you think we have heard so little about this famine? And what is the major thesis of your book?
Well, the first question is why we've heard so little. I think in the immediate aftermath of the Irish famine, Irish people were traumatised. There was a mixture of pain and, I think, to some extent, guilt for the survivors. But from very early on, the Irish famine became a symbol of British misrule in Ireland. So it became very politicised. And I think that's been one of the problems. Because of that, Irish historians perhaps haven't wanted to confront the awfulness of their past. The second question about my book, A Death-Dealing Famine, it's a quote from the Irish nationalist Daniel O'Connell. In August 1846, the potato blight came back to Ireland for the second time. And O'Connell, who resided in the south of Ireland, wrote to the British government and he said, "Unless you do something, and do something very quickly, there will be a death-dealing famine in Ireland." And sadly, he was proved right.
And what did the British do at that time?
Well, as Professor Boyle has said, there was a change of government. The new government felt that the policies they'd had in place the previous year had been too generous and they might create a culture of dependency. And they felt there was a need to cut back on those policies. Also, what's very clear is they wanted to bring about changes in Ireland, especially Irish agriculture. They didn't like the fact that so many people in Ireland ate potatoes, survived on small plots of land. And in fact, Ireland had a very fast growing population, so they wanted Ireland to modernise, and the famine and social policy became a tool for this process of modernisation to take place.
We're also joined by Owen Rogers, who is chair of the Famine Was Genocide Committee. Following up on what Professors Keneally and Boyle have said, what are you doing?
Well, I'm just the chairman. I'm putting together all these different people to have an international tribunal, hopefully in New York in October.
An international tribunal.
Yes. On the genocide of the Irish people during the famine.
How does an international tribunal work?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, or I'm just the chairperson of it. I'm an Irish activist who got all these people together, like Francis Boyle, and I will leave it up to Francis Boyle and Charlie Rice of Notre Dame Law School to put the international tribunal together. We have taken out advertisements in the Irish papers recently with approximately 150 names who have endorsed what we are doing. And it ranges from, for example, Reverend David Dyson of the Presbyterian Church in New York to Robert Menendez, Congressman Menendez, Marlene Archer, National Conference of Black Lawyers, who have endorsed us. And we just hope to get a wide spectrum of people together to actually define what happened or debate exactly what happened during the famine.
Well, let's go back to Professor Boyle. How does an international tribunal work?
Well, sure. You probably remember when we were young, the Bertrand Russell's War Crimes Tribunal during the time of the Vietnam War. Basically, a panel of experts coming together to consider a case in their private capacity, experts on law and human rights, and it would be organized along the lines of the Bertrand Russell's War Crimes Tribunal, or in 1992, the Native American groups here in the United States did not see anything to celebrate with respect to Columbus. And they established a tribunal in San Francisco in October of 92 to prosecute the United States government for committing genocide against Native Americans. And I was asked by the Native Americans to serve as the prosecutor for that tribunal. So I pretty much approached that tribunal as I did the World Court when I sued the Serbs for the Bosnians. From my perspective as an international lawyer, I don't really see all that much difference. And I took it with the same degree of seriousness as I would any other court, any other tribunal. So, as I understand it, I'm a lawyer. I'm not so much the organizer here, but there is a committee drawing up a formal proposal as to the organization of this tribunal, much along the lines of what the Native Americans did in San Francisco in 1992. And when all that planning work is prepared, I've been asked to draw up an indictment of the British government for genocide against Irish people over this mass starvation. And we have a preliminary version. I did give an opinion letter to the state of New Jersey on this question. They have what is called the Holocaust Commission that was set up pursuant to legislation in the state of New Jersey, mandating that the Jewish Holocaust be taught in New Jersey schools, and other types of genocide. And a proposal was submitted there that they also consider the Irish starvation as a form of genocide. And I was asked to submit an opinion letter to that effect, that this was genocide within the meaning of the Genocide Convention. I think the critical point to keep in mind here is that something does not have to be of the same scale and the same type as the Jewish Holocaust, nevertheless, for it to qualify as genocide. Genocide is a formal legal term of art. It has a definition in the 1948 Genocide Convention, to which the United States government is a party, and also the 1987 Genocide Convention Implementation Act, the Proxmire Resolution, making genocide a crime here in the United States. And in my opinion letter to the state of New Jersey, I pointed out that clearly the policy pursued by the British government against the Irish of mass starvation qualified on genocide on two counts. First, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, and second, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. On the basis of that opinion letter, then, the New Jersey Holocaust Commission, which at the time consisted, as I understand it, exclusively of Jewish people, approved the curriculum. As I said to a group of Irish lawyers, well, Jewish people know genocide when they see it. And so it is now the case today that the Irish famine is being taught as a form of genocide in New Jersey and, as I understand it, also in New York. And this movement will be going out nationwide. As you know, many states do have mandatory Holocaust education, and I believe the Irish famine people will be pursuing similar measures in those states that have that type of legislation, as they did in New Jersey quite successfully.
What would it take, Professor Boyle, for this case that you've written up of a genocide of the British against the Irish, what would it take for it actually to be accepted by the World Court and considered?
Sure. Well, I would need a government willing to sue the British. In the fall of 1993, acting at my advice, President Izetbegovic did instruct me to sue the British government for aiding and abetting genocide against Bosnia. And that, you know, that matter was public. I was instructed to do it. I did draw up the papers. But the British government threatened the poor Bosnians with mass starvation if they continued ahead with those proceedings. So that lawsuit was withdrawn under duress, although when I withdrew the lawsuit, I made it very clear to the World Court I was reserving Bosnia's right to sue Britain at any time for genocide. And I'd still be happy to sue the British government for the Bosnians if and when they ever decide that's what they want me to do. But to get to the World Court, I would need one government willing to sue Britain on the basis of the Genocide Convention. And it is interesting in the decision made last summer by the World Court in the Bosnia case. By the way, I won two World Court orders, there's only one case, but I won two orders for Bosnia. Last summer, the World Court rendered a ruling on the on the jurisdictional aspects of the Genocide Convention and ruled that there is no statute of limitations on genocide under the Genocide Convention. There's no reservation of time. The Serbs had argued that they could not be held accountable for anything prior to the time that Bosnia became a party to the Genocide Convention, which was late December of 92. And in my complaint, I included acts going all the way back to March of 92 when the Bosnian genocide began. and the World Court agreed with my argument that there was no statute of limitations. That's black-letter international law. There is no statute of limitations for the commission of international crimes. So, sure, if I had a government willing to sue the British for genocide, I'd be able to put that case together, and as I did for the Bosnians, and go in and do it. The problem, as I found also, you know, for the Bosnians, is that most governments are not willing to go to bat against great power permanent members of the Security Council for interests other than their own. After the British threatened the poor Bosnians and they dropped that lawsuit, I then went around to several other governments, mostly Muslim, trying to get their permission to sue the British over this, but they weren't going to do it. So this is always the problem. Where do you get a government willing to sue a permanent member of the Security Council? I don't know. When the Russians invaded Chechnya, I tried to get a government to let me sue the Russians. Again, another Muslim government. I approached three of them. I couldn't get one. So in the absence of, for the time being, of getting a government willing to sue the British in the World Court, we'll do the next best thing, which is to establish this international tribunal of experts that also can render a ruling under Article 38 of the World Court Statute. Judgments of such tribunals are a subsidiary means for the determination of the rules of international law. And indeed, the rules are somewhat different. That's the same for a World Court decision. When the World Court renders a decision, it only binds the parties to the case, and only becomes a subsidiary means for the determination of the rules of law for all other states. So it will have as much significance as the World Court ruling in the Bosnia case will have for those states not parties to the case itself.
You're listening to Professor Boyle, Professor of International Law at the University of Illinois College of Law in Champaign-Urbana. Professor Christine Keneally, in looking at your book called A Death-Dealing Famine, The Great Hunger in Ireland, you talk about a policy of extermination. How do you back that up?
Well, it's in fact a quote, and the quote was made by Lord Clarendon, who was an Englishman who'd been sent to Ireland as representative of the British government in Ireland, and who was no lover of the Irish. He described it as being thrown into the bog, being sent to Ireland, and he described what was happening in Ireland after 1849 as a policy of extermination.
How has your book been received in Britain?
Well, this particular book only came out last week, so it's still very early days. But I did write a book, This Great Calamity, which came out in 1994. And it caused, I don't know if excitement is the right word, but very much I was arguing against traditional orthodoxies, because academics for a number of years had tried to play down the famine, marginalise it or sanitise it. And the role of the British government was very much debated. There were some historians who said within the context of the time, the British government did all they could have done. And so I was very strongly arguing against that, saying that the British government knew what was going on in Ireland and had the ability to feed many of the people, but for various reasons they chose not to do so. So I think what my book has helped to do, and other books are now helping to do, is open this whole area of debate about the famine.
Right now we're seeing in Switzerland this whole debate about reparations to Jews and money actually stolen from Jews during the Holocaust and ways that it can be returned. What about adequate reparations for the Irish? What do you see as a possible, reparation?
I think financially, I don't think it's possible. It's 150 years ago. It's too long ago. So many Irish people emigrated. It's very confusing. But I think what perhaps is very important is for the British government to acknowledge its role in the famine. And there are some people who've asked for the government to apologise, which the British government has refused to do so. But some people feel that if they did so, it would be a very important part of a healing process.
Well, Owen Rogers, as chair of the Irish Famine Genocide Committee, what would you like to see? What would you hope comes out of the international tribunal that you're setting up?
Well, I first would like to, from my growing up in the north of Ireland, I would like to see actually the famine defined and to educate the people exactly what happened. There has been a tremendous interest in America. We've got tremendous response from our advertisements. In the newspapers, but hopefully I'd just like to to start a debate in America regarding the Irish famine, what exactly happened, and also to educate the people about the famine.
Yes, go ahead.
And bring in other ethnic groups and bring in other people into this debate. That is my purpose. I'm just a coordinator of all these different people, and I would like to bring in the Jewish people, Armenians, Protestants, Catholics, everybody into this debate about the Irish famine, because the Irish famine is one of the worst episodes in modern day history. I'd just like to define what happened.
Well, why don't you give the phone number of the Irish Famine Genocide Committee if people would like to get in touch with you as you move forward with this international tribunal?
The Irish Famine Genocide is based in O'Dwyer and Bernstein's. That's the law office of Paul O'Dwyer. And the address is 52 Duane Street, New York, New York, 10007. And the telephone number there is 212-571-7100.
That's 212-571-7100. Owen Rogers, thanks very much for joining us, Chair of the Irish Famine Genocide Committee. And I'd also like to thank Professor Boyle of the University of Illinois College of Law in Champaign-Urbana and Christine Keneally, Professor of British and Irish History at the University of Liverpool and author of A Death-Dealing Famine, The Great Hunger in Ireland. Thanks for being with us. When we come back, we're going to speak with Bernadette Devlin McCalliskey about her daughter Roisin and what's happening with her in the Holloway Prison in Britain. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Irish civil rights leader Bernadette Devlin McCalliskey's 25-year-old pregnant daughter, Roisin, sits in an isolated high-security prison in London, England. She's awaiting extradition to Germany on charges that she attempted to murder 150 British soldiers as part of an IRA commando operation last year. Roisin's supporters say she's been framed because of her political beliefs and because British officials are using Roisin as a way to punish her mother. And international human rights groups have complained about the conditions under which Roisin, who is in ill health and pregnant, is jailed in an English high-security prison. Joining us today to talk about Roisin's case is her mother, Bernadette Devlin McCalliskey. Bernadette rose to international prominence in the 1960s and 70s, leading the civil rights struggles of Northern Ireland's poor Catholic communities. She was subsequently the youngest woman ever to be elected to the British Parliament. And we welcome you to Democracy Now! Once again, Bernadette.
Hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
Hi, something just went seriously wrong with your sound, but I can hear you enough to pick up what you're saying. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm speaking to you from my home in Cole Island in County Tyrone.
In County Tyrone. Well, tell us the latest on your daughter, Roisin. I know that there was a hearing for her this past Friday.
Yeah, I think, right, the first thing I think that has to be understood, Amy, because when you were introducing it, you said my daughter was facing charges in Germany. The first problem that we're facing is my daughter is not charged with anything, nor are the Germans seeking her extradition on charges so that she may be tried. The Germans are demanding that she be extradited to Germany for questioning only. with a possibility of being charged and equally with a possibility of not being charged. They have asked only that she be arrested and extradited to Germany to be questioned about possible involvement in this Osnabrück attack. Now, this is something that would not happen, for example, in America, where a person can only be extradited in or out of America in order to be charged and face trial. That's our first problem. The second problem, then, is that it's quite a unique position that Roisin is in. She has been deprived of her liberty and remanded in custody, not charged with a serious offence and awaiting trial, but remanded in custody now from November 27th, awaiting the possibility of being charged. She has repeatedly gone, because of this position, she's repeatedly gone to the court for bail, and last Tuesday went to the High Court, which is the next highest level, for bail. The case was adjourned until Friday. The judge, quite clearly not being permitted to give bail, salved his own conscience by adjourning the case for a number of days and using the court to force the British political administration, the Home Office, into dealing with the more gross abuses of human rights. So between Tuesday and Friday, the court forced the political executive to clarify for Roisin the circumstances of the birth of her child. Roisin is now 7 months pregnant. And she was given an undertaking in the court that she would now not, as she had previously been told, she would now not be shackled during the actual birth. The Home Office said she would not be shackled while in hospital, and the court required them to produce a statement in writing to Roisin to that effect. They also informed the court that they would not now separate her at birth from her baby, but the period at which she will be separated for the child now becomes an administrative decision at some further point, somewhere between 2 months and in the longest term, 9 months.
Where would the baby...
So very, very small human rights concessions have been wrung from the political executive through the court, but the court has still refused to address the basic issue that Roisin has not been charged with an offence. Her extradition is not being sought for the sole purpose of charging her and putting her on trial, but for the purpose of questioning her with a view to possibly being charged and equally possibly not. However, she would be imprisoned in Germany while under their long investigative process, and the experience of other Irish prisoners has been that being interrogated or investigated under the German system could take another 18 months. It's not simply a question where she would go to Germany for questioning, which might take a few hours or days and then be released. She could be imprisoned in Germany for anything up to 18 months awaiting the outcome of an investigation determining whether she would be charged at all, and if so, with what offence. But the maximum offence that they would consider charging her with is attempted murder of 150 soldiers, although they have produced no evidence or indication of the existence of evidence which would sustain a charge of that nature.
Well, Bernadette Devlin-Mikulski, I just want to let our listeners know we're really sorry about the quality of the phone line. We are talking to Bernadette in County Tyrone, Northern Ireland, but it seems that we have a worse line with you, Bernadette, than we do with other people who we call in the area. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think that's because I share mine with the police.
Well, it's muffled, but we can make out what you're saying. What we understand is that the German or the British government, I'm not sure which, has come up with a cellophane wrapping for a pack of cigarettes that has the fingerprints of your daughter, Roisin, on it that they say they found in a dumpster in Germany outside an apartment. Is that right?
Well, yes. What they are saying is that they believe that two fingerprints on a snippet of plastic paper match those of my daughter. They have refused to say what a snippet of plastic paper is. And at different times, they have said, A, it is the cellophane wrapping on a packet of cigarettes. Then alternatively, in answer to other people asking them the question, they have said it's on the external wrapping of a packet of biscuits. They have also said that the snippet of paper, plastic paper, is actually a torn piece of plastic carrier bag. Now, Roisin's lawyers have officially approached the Germans for copies of the binding of these fingerprints, clarification of what they're supposed to be on, the exact location of where they were found, who took them, who identified them and at what time as Roisin's, and she has been denied all that information. The Germans also say that they have one witness who, on the basis of a photograph of Roisin taken by the police in Northern Ireland while she was under interrogation there and sent to Germany, has been identified by the witness as one of the women who stayed in a house he owned 70 miles from Osnabrück. The defence have also asked that a copy of this statement be given to the defence, and that has been denied.
Mm. It's also interesting, and we've spoken about this before on Democracy Now! With you, Bernadette, that if this were the other way around, and if Roisin was in Germany, Germany has in its constitution that it will not extradite its own citizens to any other country.
Yes, if Roisin was a German citizen living in Germany and actually charged, even with a cast iron case, with any criminal offence, terrorism, well, she'd be too young for Nazi war crimes, but I think that's where the German constitution to protect its citizens originates. But it would be of no consequence if Roisin was a German citizen who had gone to America and been responsible for the bombing in Oklahoma, and that could be categorically proven. The German government would not extradite their own citizens to stand trial in any part of the world other than in Germany themselves. And they would put such a person on trial in Germany. All the European countries, including Britain, Roisin could be put on trial in Britain. Irish citizens before the Irish courts could be put on trial in Ireland. But the Germans will not come up with a charge on which they would like her to be charged, and the British refused to come up with the possibility of actually charging her here and adjudicating the evidence here. And the only reason that can exist for that is that there is no evidence and there is no charge.
Bernadette, I'm looking at a New York Post article of this weekend that says government minister, this is British government minister David McLean, said in a letter published last week in a British newspaper that he had no more sympathy for McCloskey than for a serial killer. In a reply to one of his constituents who'd complained about McCloskey's treatment, McLean wrote, "When the day comes that the evil scum of the IRA are no longer murdering the innocent and our children are no longer tortured by the Hindleys of this world, then I am certain that when I no longer need all my compassion for the innocent, I shall be able to spare some for the perpetrators."
Yes.
What is your response to McLean?
It was absolutely incredible. This guy, Mr. McLean, is a minister in the Home Office responsible for Roisin's treatment and responsible for criminal policy within the Home Office, which would be like your State Department for domestic or internal affairs. He consistently, as I say, despite the fact that Roisin has not been charged with any offence and it has not even been indicated that she is suspected of membership of the IRA. In the course of his letter, he referred to her as the IRA prisoner throughout. His letter was written to an 80-year-old woman who had written asking, as a woman, for compassion for Roisin in the way she was being treated by the state. The letter he wrote back was enough to give the old lady a heart attack, and it was her pastor who sent it on to the bishop in the Church of England, who was so appalled by it that he felt it necessary to publicise that a minister could be in such breach of the court and could write in such a fascist manner to a constituent. Roisin, as I say, has not been charged with any offence. The other woman referred to is a convicted serial killer, as you say, who in fact sexually abused and strangled children. And to have made the comparison between her, and she has served many years in prison. In fact, the woman has served so long in prison that there is a movement to have her released. She has served maybe 25 years at this stage. However, to have compared Roisin, who is a young woman pregnant, in danger of losing her own child because of the way she's been treated by the government, with a convicted woman whose crime had been to sexually abuse other people's children was beyond comprehension and beyond disgust.
Bernadette, we have the news, we read it earlier in the show, that British Prime Minister John Major has called a national election for May 1st. And it made me think back to a month or so ago on Democracy Now! When we talked about the movie Another Mother's Son about the hunger strikers led by Bobby Sands and how he ran for parliament from prison. Is there any discussion of that possibility for Roisin?
There's a great deal of discussion about that, and we haven't taken a decision as yet on it. It's a big decision for Roisin herself because she has sufficient problems, but it may be necessary in order to demonstrate the point, and we will take a decision on it in the very near future.
I know that there are actions all over the world around your daughter, Roisin McCallisky. What is being called for from people around the world? And in just a minute, I want to bring in Martha Swan, who is a member of the Friends of Roisin McCallisky here in the United States. She's also development director at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. But what is happening on this day, St. Patrick's Day?
Well, we actually concentrated our activities internationally for Roisin on International Women's Day, because the issue goes beyond simply the question of Irish prisoners. Roisin is Irish. She's also a young woman. She's also a young woman in childbirth. And so we picked International Women's Day to bring all of those features together. I understand in New York people are carrying a rose for Roisin, and that within many of the St. Patrick's Day parades, which are much bigger in America than they are in Ireland, in the north of Ireland, St. Patrick's Day is not even a public holiday.
Well, Martha Swan.
Martha probably can give you better details on the American situation. And I, if I may, Amy, must go. I'm hoping my daughter will ring me at 3 o'clock.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Bernadette Devlin McCallisky, speaking to us from her home in County Tyrone in Northern Ireland. And you can hear how difficult it was to hear her. It has happened like this before, and she says that she shares a line with the police who are listening in. Martha, we just have a minute. How can people contact Friends of Roisin McCallisky, and what can people do here in the United States?
Well, if people are going to turn out for the parade today, they can turn out carrying roses, which is one symbolic gesture, which we hope will help draw attention to Roisin and Roisin's plight. The contact phone number for the Friends of Roisin Committee is 718-436-4770. We meet every Friday night at Rocky Sullivan's Pub, which is on Lexington around 28th, 29th Street. People are more than welcome to come.
That's in New York City. This is a show that airs around the country. That number again, 718-436-4770. That's 718-436-4770. Well, Martha, thanks for joining us. And again, thanks to Bernadette Devlin McCallisky. We want to welcome radio station KUNM back to Democracy Now!, broadcasting throughout Albuquerque, New Mexico. And we'd love to hear from you folks. You can call our comment line at 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999. 9999 extension 313. And if you'd like a copy of this St. Patrick's Day special or any other program we've done on Democracy Now!, you can call our 800 number to order a cassette, 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin and Errol Maitland. Ken Mason and Errol Maitland are engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!